Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have two guests joining me tonight. This is a first, I think. I don't know if I've had two guests on the show once before, but I'm delighted to have them both. My good friends from the Pink Smoke, Mr. John Cribbs and Mr. Christopher Funderburg, thank you guys so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks, Brian.
My pleasure. So this is an interesting evening we're going to have here because we're talking about Tobe Hooper. And as I told you guys off mic, I feel out of my depth because I've heard you guys' podcasts on The Wrong Reel, etc., wherein there's a whole lot of knowledge about Tobe Hooper there. And I know him, but I don't know him at the level you guys do. And we're talking about a movie I've never seen until this weekend, and that is The Mangler from 1995.
There's a little bit of me in that machine, and a little bit of it in me.
There was an accident today. The worst one I've ever seen.
Have you considered the possibility that the machine might be haunted?
That machine killed your daughter.
We all have to make sacrifices.
Human sacrifices.
A demon is a kind of electricity. Sometimes it gets out of control. People get hurt.
Three modern masters of horror have just created the ultimate machine for terror. The Mangler.
A movie that blew your mind, no doubt.
We can talk about it.
Possibly the most Tobe Hooper movie.
Oh,
not his best, but it's maybe the most Tobe Hooper. What do you think about that, John?
I think it's
that controversial. It's his
Gremlins too, without a doubt.
Oh, I like this. This is great. You guys are giving me some context here. This is cool. So this was an episode that I think John had pitched to me a while ago when this was announced. John had said that me and Funderburg want to come on the show and talk about The Mangler, and I was like, hell yes. I haven't seen it, but I would love to see it and talk to you guys about it. What, you know, should we describe the movie before we get into this discussion, or what do you guys think?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. to give everybody some context.
How would either one of you take this? How would you describe The Mangler to somebody that's not seen it?
Haunted laundry machine. What more do you need to know? Is there anything else to it beyond that?
It's a good
or
sell.
Or perhaps possessed is a better word.
That's the windup and the pitch. It's true. He does.
Very nice.
He does use the word specifically possessed, not haunted.
That is true. So what is it about this haunted laundry machine? And by the way, when I knew
I
that
mean, also, well, to be fair, it's not just a haunted laundry machine. It gets called the haunted laundry machine movie a lot of the time, but it's also a haunted refrigerator movie as well, which I think gets overlooked.
It does get overlooked.
Discussing The Mangler.
It does get overlooked. And I was not prepared for the haunted refrigerator sidetrack for a minute there. But what I'd always heard was the haunted laundry machine angle. And I guess I always pictured like a laundry room, you know, a very small machine. And I was just always like, what could possibly be so threatening about that? But of course, this machine is a gigantic, you know, industrial, you know, cleans big old sheets, pulls them in and sucks people in and chops them up kind of machine.
Folds them up, squishes them down in this like mist of red blood and, you know, effluvia.
Well, mangle itself is like an old laundry room term for folding, just the folding of clothes. What's called to mangle a sheet, you know?
I did not know that.
And that's why it has that delicious little, you know, double meaning there. But
very
it's,
nice.
It's important to mention, of course, that this is adapted from a 20-page Stephen King short story from early in his career, which comes from Stephen King's memories of working in an industrial laundry before he, you know, was famous, you know, in the summers between teaching gigs, where he describes putting the sheets into, like, you know, the searing hot water, burning his hands with lye and having bugs from the, you know, lobster encrusted tablecloths from, you know, the local seafood restaurants in Maine crawling up his arms as he was washing them just makes it sound like the most miserable job you can imagine. And even, it turns out, this I didn't know, but his mom even worked in a laundry room for years, you know, when she was raising him as a single mother. So he definitely has a background in, like, reasons to hate laundries. But you're right to say, you know, that you didn't expect this huge laundry machine. When people are hearing about this movie, they probably do think about, like, a little laundromat or something like that. But this is what Chris means when he says it's the most Tobey Hooper movie. That massive mangler in this film is just like an envision of a madman, of like Tobey Hooper's, you know. And it was actually designed by his son William and built by his son William on the set. And supposedly it actually worked. It could actually fold laundry. So, I mean, that's pretty impressive.
It actually worked. You could actually sacrifice virgins in it and become successful beyond your wildest dreams.
You got to test that out first. That's
maimed
a good,
people
good
for real.
So what is it about this movie, you guys, that Chris, you said most Tobey Hooper, so that would mean, that would make me understand partially why it has a special place. Is that what it is for you guys? What is it about this movie that really, you know, makes it stand out for you guys?
It's an incredibly weird movie. This is a movie that gets a bad reputation because on its surface, it's ludicrous in a lot of ways, and it's completely over the top. And just about any element that you could pick is goes further than necessary and is realistic. And I think that part of the misunderstanding of it is like when you say haunted laundry machine, that sounds so crazy. Like Stephen King and Tobey Hooper know that. Like that's not an observation you're making as an audience. That's a thing they're doing as artists, right? And so this movie comes from a place of just going, piling sort of these weird, artificial, strange Baroque ideas on top of each other, from like Robert Englund's character to the laundry machine to like the ghosts and the neighbor character and even Ted Levine's performance. It just keeps sort of piling it on, and piling it on specifically in ways that we've seen Tobey Hooper pile it on before in his career. It has a lot of his weird thematic ideas, like the sort of secret subterranean thing, like occult space lurking below an already kind of bad and weird place, like the mazes below Alamo Land and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, or the sort of secret chambers you find in his movies throughout them. Salem's Lot is another
fun house. I was just thinking
fun house. Yeah. Apartment.
No,
yeah. That is, I think, why I like and enjoy this movie so much, is that it really is. It's just so strange, and it's just so intentionally strange that it's very, very memorable. And I think it gets like a fair amount of Tobey Hooper's work labeled as the work of someone who's not in control of what they're doing, because it is like a sort of spiritually messy film. You know, it's just on its surface, it's a movie that wants to make a lot of messes, not just in the crushed squirting of blood and bodies, but just in its story and its ideas as well. And But I think that's on purpose. I think that's something that Tobey Hooper does consistently throughout his career in a way that makes it, you can't argue that he's not in control of what he's doing here. But John, this is what you and I were just discussing, where it's a movie for me that's beyond good or bad as a descriptor. You know, that it's just gone someplace totally haywire and strange for me. But John, you think it's a really good movie according to traditional terms, which is something I'm not 100% sure I agree with. And I'd be curious what Brian thinks of that as well.
Well, traditional
go for it,
terms
John.
Is a who am I to say what, you know, a good movie by traditional terms is. I think it's a film.
Is it better or worse than Out of Africa?
That's definitely better appreciated. It was shot in South Africa, so that's kind of... it's a film that I think is better appreciated when you know the director, when you know his work so well, because so many of the themes in the film seem like his whole career was leading up to this, you know? I'm sure that I'm somewhat biased because of that, because of my love of Tobe Hooper, because everything that he's been making, all his themes about institutions and the way things are and the way that society is set up, you know, these little tiny societies that he's interested in, you know, comes out in full force in this film, so that it's beyond being a haunted laundry machine movie. It gets into like that area, that idea of this town that, you know, thrives because of this laundry machine somehow, that it, you know, sacrifices into this machine, that the blood literally is in the machine, and that the people who are not at the top are the ones, you know, being fed to the machine, is something that Hooper was interested in from the very beginning. You know, it's all the way back to Texas Chainsaw. And the fact that he would come and make this movie, take the Stephen King short story and turn it into a Tobe Hooper opus the way he did, it's just the kind of thing that doesn't happen anymore. It's just the kind of miracle that this thing exists. So would I say it's good in traditional terms? I think it works fine as the story that it is, but I think it works even better just for everything that you bring into it yourself as a viewer, and just kind of the experience that you leave with. But yeah, I am dying to know, Brian, what your impressions of this film were, having just seen it, you know, for the first time.
Well, I wouldn't say, if there is a popular opinion that it's not a good movie, I don't agree with that, for sure.
That's
one of those where I watched it, and I know my initial take is not going to be my final take. You know, like, it was a movie that I actually felt like was beyond me in a way, you know? It's weird because it's such a simple story, but it was one where I'm like, there's something here and I feel it, and it's hypnotic, and it has this, I don't know, I want to do a deep dive into Toby's filmography. I know his films, but I usually tend to watch them in scattered bits, singles, and I have good friends like you guys and Patrick Bromley who are huge, huge fans. And so I know that I need to take some time with him and really dig deep and understand more the thematics and the things you're talking about. Because when you talk about it this way, I'm like, yeah, I do kind of see what you're talking about. I do see these things he's doing, this overarching craftsmanship and stuff. And it's well made. It's a movie that I think, for me, like I said, it's... My initial viewing was very cursory, in that I know I'm going to watch it again and have different impressions. It was just that initial, like, okay, what is this? What is this haunted laundry machine movie that everybody's talking about? And so, I don't know. There's a lot of things that I found really fascinating about it, including, and this came out in the commentary, the interview with Englund, where he said that his character, he based some of it on Everett Sloan and Lady from Shanghai and a bit of Harry S. Truman. And I was like, wow, that is awesome. And he definitely...
And the mechanical legs were also his idea, right?
A very good touch. Yes, they were.
I'm sorry.
Chaos abounds, my dear. You'd better get used to it. Like I told you, there's no free lunch, no sorry, Bob, not in this lifetime. Still, life must be better here than on the streets. Here the predators are few, benefits are many. For I am a generous man. I am a man of my word. Now then. Why don't you go in there and freshen up for your Uncle Billy?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, no, he's really interesting. And it was interesting to hear in the commentary, too, that he's... I mean, I guess it should be obvious, maybe, but he loves makeup. He loves to, you know, act in makeup. And I could see how certain actors would really thrive on it and be able to, you know, use it to their advantage to immerse themselves in a character, you know? And he seems to be a guy that can really do that. And the more I see of his stuff, the more I respect him beyond, well beyond just, you know, the iconic Freddy Krueger performance. Like, he's something else. There's something about him that is incredibly special. And I'm both shocked and sort of moved by the fact that I'm just now coming to discover it this late in my life. But, you know, it's like I said, there's a hypnotic quality to it. There's a, I don't know even how to qualify my response to it, because it's like one of those things where I'm like, it wasn't what I expected, and I don't know what I expected, and it doesn't play like it has some aspects of like traditional, I guess, like a monster movie kind of thing, but then it's got a whole bunch of other things going on in there, and I guess that's the Toby of it, you know? So I don't know. I'm definitely still processing, but I wouldn't say that I came away going, well, that sucked. You know, I don't get it at all. It was not that kind of response. Like, I almost hesitated to grade it on Letterboxd because I'm like, I don't think this isn't going to be where it stands. But right now, this is it. And so it's one of those things where I want to come back to it. I want to just gestate with it. But it's really a fascinating movie, I got to say. And I thank you guys for, you know, pitching the show, because it wouldn't have been one that I hate to be so, I don't know, going along with, I guess, some of the popular opinion of the film, but I wouldn't necessarily have, you know, dove in outside of anything but morbid curiosity, if not for the fact that you guys were excited about it. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, that's too a lot of kudos to Shout Factory, Scream Factory. Maybe you can clear up. I never know what they want to be called these days, you know?
I mean, I always, unless it's a specifically Shout title, you know, if it's a horror movie, I always say Scream. Mm-hmm. I know that it's obviously they're under the Shout umbrella, but I think that I've had them correct me when I claimed on Twitter, like, that there was a one was the other. I think it was, like I said, certain release was a Scream release, and they're like, no, it's not ours, meaning there is a differentiation for them, which is right. Fine, you know,
it's,
I get it,
confusing,
you know?
But whatever. I mean, we know, yeah. we know it's coming from that these guys are, you know, doing the good work.
Absolutely.
And there have been, so it's funny because I always look at back at the 90s in terms of horror movies and think it's not a great decade, because there aren't stone cold classics like there were in the 70s and the 80s, you know. It's such a scattered catalog.
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking about this because you were talking about how this is what Toby Hooper's career was building up to. I always think of this movie as like the last of the golden age of horror movies, of that like sort of like the 80s horror movies that really start sometime in the late 70s and run through the mid 90s. This is like the last 80s horror movie made with a ton of gore, released by New Line Cinema, put on a bunch of screens, put out in theaters. And if you look at the other movies that are released the same year, the other horror movies, it's very slim pickings, like you're saying, John. And then the second half of the decade becomes the famous, you know, the WB actor teen horror movies that really get slagged a lot.
And also, like, right at the dawn of CG taking over, too. You know, like, last time practical effects were really utilized in a film.
Yeah, one of the last really big gore fests, you know, that got released on the big screen, where people, part of the idea is you're going to get an audience in to see these crazy effects as well. That's the mindset behind what they're doing with a film like this. And in some ways, it feels, I agree with you, John, it feels like the culmination of something. It feels like the signal that an era is over, either for Hooper or for horror film in general, that this is like a weird monument. And its failure in the way it's derided critically and commercially was a failure. I think also signals that, like, audiences are changing now, when there's a new generation coming up that wants something other than this as well, which I think makes it a sort of like tragic story that it's the culmination of Hooper's career and it's coming at the exact wrong moment for it.
I totally agree. And, you know, a movie that I never compared it to until I watched it this time, because they're not really similar, you know, plot-wise or anything, but is Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness, which came out a year or two before, and definitely has that same sort of, like, a feel of like a culminating or an ending of sorts, And of course, literally ending in a giant apocalypse. But yeah. Specifically, it also has
the two main characters going, "This is not reality," and then the other one goes, "Bullshit reality."
That's exactly what made me think of it. Was Ted Levine that's going, so funny. "Bullshit reality, bullshit reality."
Reality, bullshit, bullshit, reality. Yeah, this is not reality. Well, we're on the same page, John.
Yeah.
You and I should start a website together.
That sounds great. What a great idea. Yeah, no, that's such an interesting an interesting context to place it in terms of the, you know, end of something and the sort of place where it stands in the 90s. I was thinking part of the reason that I didn't see this movie was because I had forever crossed it with the Burt Reynolds horror movie, The Maddening, which...
John Cribbs' favorite movie of all time. Are you aware of this?
Okay. I did not know that.
You really didn't know that? You're bringing up The Maddening without knowing you're talking to, like, The Maddening's number one super fan? Am I missing something? Is
no,
this a joke?
It's not a joke. I did not know that. John
this,
and I have somehow never covered The Maddening.
This is the way Brian Sauer and my universe is just cross effortlessly with each other. Just happens.
Oh my God, has it been an accident? Is my wife hurt?
She was supposed to arrive last night, never showed up.
Hi.
Come on, come in the house. I'll bet you're hungry. Oh my God.
Georgina has it in her head, but you are her sister.
I really need to see your husband, okay?
Roy's working on your car.
Don't lock me in this room.
I'll do anything you want, but you gotta let me out.
I gotta see my little girl.
Just let me out of this house!
Got your trace back on your suspected family slayer.
Was it a woman with a little child, a little girl?
Mr. Scudder told her to take Old Highway 50.
What makes you think you're gonna find your wife and your daughter around my dirty old garage?
Hey, Samantha!
I remember the cover for that one, and this is prime time video store employment years for me. I was at Blockbuster Video, I was shelving movies, and there's something about the act of shelving movies that can be detrimental to your viewing habits, because you are forced to see certain things over and over again and make impressions and make judgments. And when you only have a certain amount of movies you can take home, regardless of the fact that it is nice to have a lot that you can watch, sometimes you have a shorthand that you develop and you look at that Burt Reynolds movie and, no offense, John, you just go, I don't know if I want to see that. And then somehow The Mangler comes out and I swear they were close together, maybe alphabetically or...
Yeah, Mangler and Maddening.
And they're both 95. Yeah, you know, they're both right around the same time. So something happened where I didn't go to either. I didn't watch either one.
Sir, so. As you know, I donned the blue shirt at the exact same time that you were, that same era. So I know exactly what you mean. You know, like by the 100th time you're running Chain Reaction to somebody, you're like, I don't need to see this movie.
Chain Reaction. Oh my God. That was filmed on the campus where I went to school. That was the only thing that made it even remotely, maybe making me want to watch
it. No kidding.
But yeah. But anyway, well, that's cool. Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about. So there, I can't imagine how many other movies I missed based on some impression I made in the mid 90s, you know, that I haven't finally gotten around to, you know. It's a strange thing.
Well, yeah, I think that's great about Scream Factory is that, you know, it's really making me want to revisit some of these things that I felt the same way about, that, you know, I just kind of dismissed out of hand as like, this is just some 90s schlock that's just not as good as the stuff that came before, you know, that just didn't spark my interest at the time when, you know, you could get excited about the Coen brothers or Train Spotting or whatever, you know, things that felt like new and going into a different direction. And so the horror phase for me at that point was a little stale. So I definitely missed a lot. And when I first saw The Mangler, I didn't come back to The Mangler and really fall in love with it until a few years ago. You know, when I first saw it, I liked it and I enjoyed it, but I didn't think, you know, it was one of his best movies. And now I'm of the opinion that it's, you know, I absolutely love it.
Wow.
I saw it in the theater on a date.
Nice.
Mangler. Yes. I took a young lady to see The Mangler.
How did
True
that go?
Story. I think it went fine. I don't have a lot of memories one way or the other about caring whether women have enjoyed the dates they've been on with me or not. No, but there's no pitch for this movie either to make you want to see it. You know what I mean? I guess it's based on Stephen King is the closest you get to it.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It's a movie that's easy to overlook. But John, I agree with you too. You were saying that horror was feeling played out. Like really that year, that time frame, I was just thinking, it's like Halloween 6 came out that year, you know, and Wes Craven was doing Vampire in Brooklyn, right?
Oof.
Right? Like, this is the year that's happening. And I think that the Kim Henkel Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie is also right around then. It just felt like what was happening in horror was coming to a close in a lot of ways, that it didn't feel like it's new and exciting. So I understand both of you guys not being true original theater goers of the Mangler, such as I.
I'm impressed, man. Yeah, no, there's something about, you know, being in that milieu of all the horror movies of that period, that some theatrical, but a lot of, you know, straight to video stuff, and them all getting sort of mixed together. And in my mind, I feel like I've come a long way from that kid in college, but it's sort of lowered my opinion of horror for a little while, because I was just seeing so much garbage I perceived in my mind as garbage, which is unfair. But yeah, I was going
to
say, John,
I think it's fair to call Vampire in Brooklyn garbage.
The only one I noticed, Demon Knight came out in 95, and I still hold that to be a pretty solid one.
That's
but, yeah,
a classic.
But even Demon Knight, you know, it's like, you know, that was, you know, a spinoff from a TV show. You know, it didn't feel like here is like a cool new original thing that's happening. So even though it's a good movie, it just felt like, you know, a spinoff in a way. There's also like a cynicism from like how this movie was marketed by being like, from the guy who made Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Freddy Krueger, Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs, in a Stephen King movie. It just felt really cheap. You know, it felt like a way of just throwing out as many brand names as you can think of, because obviously you don't get Buffalo Bill in this movie. You don't get Freddy Krueger in this movie. And of course, Stephen King's contribution is that he wrote a 20-page short story in the 70s. And, you know, it's all it is. It's a Toby Hooper film, you know, and that's what you're going to get. But so it was a lot of branding, and it was a lot of just trying to market their way out of, you know, this sinking genre at the time that, you know, at the time you look at it and you think, I'm not hooked by it. I'm not tricked by this. You know, I'm not going to fall for this phony studio advertising in any way. But I think people who did go take dates to go see it definitely didn't know what they were getting into.
I knew what I was getting into. I'm pretty sure by that time, I'm pretty sure that Texas Chainsaw Massacre was my favorite movie by that time. I was 16. Yeah, it would have been right around then. And that's almost certainly what possessed me to see it. It's also interesting that you mentioned Demon Knight and you talk about it being a spinoff. This time, when I watched this again to do the episode, it reminded me a lot of Toby Hooper's Tales from the Crypt episode in its tone, and just the way there's sort of the young woman conspiring with the sort of gross older guy to do magic, evil black magic as well, and how they're both very set-bound films. Something about it struck me as this is like a very Tales from the Crypt-y sort of tone to this film in some way. And even that, Tales from the Crypt is a sort of winking retake on a horror genre that's maybe wearing itself out at that point as well. So it's just I don't know if this movie's released in 1986, if it gets better received, or if it's just treated like Spontaneous Combustion where people are like, what the fuck was that? You know? So
I'm a huge Spontaneous Combustion fan, by the way, just throwing that out.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
I don't know
if it's great.
I'm a big fan. I like it a lot.
Toby Hooper, the director of Poltergeist. Toby Hooper, the modern master of the macabre, now brings you his greatest achievement. In the spring of 1955.
Okay, Brian, Peggy, very soon. Ready now. Ready.
A secret experiment began. An experiment that left one survivor.
The vital signs are all perfect. There's no signs of radiation.
Now, the child has become a man.
Well, that looks like you've lived. Got a slight fever.
A man who doesn't know the secret of his past.
My parents didn't burn to death, they drowned.
Something's happening to me.
Two people I know burned to death.
Or the terror of his future.
They're watching me.
Nobody's interested.
Before his enemies can stop him.
Step back!
Before his gift will transform him.
The doctor can save your life. There is a vaccine.
Sam Kramer must uncover the mystery of his own life.
By all rights, you should never have been born. And if it wasn't for me, you never would have been.
And fight fire.
I will use my gift.
With fire. Spontaneous Combustion, starring Academy Award nominee Brad Dourif, Melinda Dillon, and Cynthia Bain.
God damn you!
Spontaneous Combustion.
That's cool. I liked in the commentary they mentioned that the fire at the end when the mangler pitches into the water was leftover effects from Spontaneous Combustion that they used as a tribute to Toby.
Nice. Very nice. Yeah, no, I only saw Spontaneous for the first time, I want to say, within the past 5 years, and I was really taken by it. Really, really dug it. So
it's good. It's got a similar weirdo character actor in the lead role thing going on with it, too, where it's like only Tobe Hooper would have the idea to be like, my movie will star Ted Levine. You know, my movie will star Brad Dourif as the regular, you know, hero of the film.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the Tales from the Crypt, because now I'm thinking about it, Remar's performance in that is so much like Levine's in that, what the hell is going on here is his perpetual thing, but it's like, but you know you're weird too, right?
Yeah.
Like you're part of what's weird.
You understand you're like
weird.
A gravelly voiced maniac, right? Like you're James Remar. You understand that, don't you?
Oh, I love it. John, I was just going to add, well, when we're on the topic of Scream Factory and these nice releases, I mean, not to be too cynical about what's coming out in theaters these days, because I certainly go just about every weekend, but I do find myself getting, and obviously that's a product of having a Blu-ray show, I will say, but I do find myself getting very excited about these releases, because that is like my theatrical, you know, it's time, it's this movie's time now. It's the Mangler's come to Blu-ray. Now is the time when I will sit down and enjoy it, and it's almost as pleasurable for me in a lot of ways as going to the theater for the first time to see a new movie, is to be given the gift of a new nice Blu-ray of an older film and to be able to go like, okay, I'm gonna look at this again now, and maybe some other people will, and we'll talk about it on social media. It's this movie's time to get a little more attention, and you know that other people might play along, and I just love that feeling. I love the idea of like, what's new this week, you know, old new, that is, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I feel the same way, especially with this movie, where, you know, it came out originally on VHS in like an R-rated and an unrated director's cut version, which are not different at all. There's like,
yeah, I couldn't tell the difference.
60 seconds worth of difference in terms of like gore effects and stuff like that were cut out. And then the WB archive DVD that came out that was not the director's cut. So everyone, you know, got up in the, you know, arms about that. So to finally have a version, it's like, we're not going to do any bullshit. This is just the version that Toby wanted out there. And it's cleaned up and it's looking great. And you're right. It's like rediscovering. It's like seeing an old movie for the first time. It's terrific. I have that same feeling.
It's wonderful. Do you guys know much about Toby's feelings about the movie? Have you read about his response, or, you know, what his thoughts were going in?
He's not super articulate when talking about his own work. I feel like I don't know his feelings about any of his movies.
Oh,
do
really?
You, John?
No, yeah. He's very tight-lipped about it.
I started making horror films, really trying to give people their money's worth. Myself, I was a horror buff, sci-fi fan, and I never... That is when I started with Chainsaw. Before that, I saw very few horror films that worked. You know, they gave me really what I was going to see. I felt cheated. So that's how Texas Chainsaw came about. And it was low budget. That's about as much money as I could scrape together for one more film. So no matter how small a project is. I would advise anyone who wants to direct pictures to get on with it and somehow find a way to do it. If it's on a $15 budget, if it's on a $200 budget, just do it. Because the opportunity probably won't just come your way.
And he's also somebody who was just perpetually boned by his producers, by his distributors, by his collaborators. He's just somebody who spent his entire career from basically from Texas Chainsaw Massacre on getting fucked over in his career. That you would think Texas Chainsaw Massacre's next movie, he'd get to do what he wanted, and even that movie he gets taken, eaten alive, gets taken away from him and redone. And just at the very next one, there's very few instances of him seeming to have basically complete control without being undermined by anybody from stop to start. I mean, the Funhouse, right, John? Are there any others?
Salem's Lot is the best example of when he worked with a producer who supported him and let him do what he wanted to do. And I'm sure that probably informed his decision to want to do another Stephen King adaptation, was his good experience on that, his relationship with Stephen King. You know, I'm sure he went into this thinking, not only, you know, was this going to be like, you know, a big career push, since it was going to be another big theatrical release after having a series of flops, but like it was going to be a high profile Stephen King movie. But again, it runs into that like problem with the 90s, with the fact that there were six other Stephen King adaptations that came out that year. You know, there was just, they're just strangling the market with all this Stephen King, and couldn't tell what was going to be interesting and what was going to be complete dreck. Like, you know, just taking the name of his story and slapping it on to something that is completely unrelated.
Like what, John?
The Lawnmower Man.
I was looking at the films adapted from the Night Shift short story collection, and it's also just like, did it suffer from so many of those movies being mediocre to bad that had already been adapted from that collection? Like, it feels like in 1995 a little poisonous to be like, taken from the same collection as Lawnmower Man and Children of the Corn, and, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And Cat's Eye. You know, it just feels like setting it up for failure in some way. From the short story collection that brought you Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that it was destined to fail for like all of those reasons. But it's funny. The only thing I had to go on before getting to listen to this commentary and this interview with England for me was an old Fangoria that came out right before the movie was released, where Hooper is very optimistic about the film, and he, you know, talked about, this was the first film apparently that Stephen King had script approval on. So he actually had like met with King and screened the film for him, and King seemed really happy with it. He had planned to shoot it in Toronto, but this is revealed in the DVD, the new Blu-ray, that the producer, Amant Singh, was Michael Jackson's producer. And when Michael Jackson got into the trouble around this time, they canceled his tour in South Africa specifically. And so they owed South Africa tons of money for canceling this tour. So he moved the whole production of The Mangler down to South Africa specifically to, you know, as a way to, like, you know, give restitution to these guys. Since MJ wasn't coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they were the ones who were really wronged in that scenario. They deserve the restitution.
But weirdly enough, this is one of the few King adaptations that specifically says it's Maine, you know, it says it's set in Maine, even though it's, you know, shot in Johannesburg. So I think that that's like just a crazy thing to have to walk into that, you know, to create a Maine looking town. And they said like that the houses that they found for Hunton's house, for Ted Levine's house, were like the only houses of Johannesburg, not surrounded by like a 10-foot wall fence, you know, with barbed wire and everything. Like, it was impossible for them to find any locations that they could actually use. But I think that it really adds to just the kind of otherworldliness of this film, or just the kind of weird offness that, you know, you kind of appreciate in Tobe Hooper movies. To complement the, you know, obvious the set design, the production design of the laundry factory itself. So there's just so much like going to this film and the production. But that literally is all I knew about it, was that, you know, they had shot in South Africa and that Toby got a nice vacation while he was down there after the film was wrapped. I've heard stories that Singh afterwards did kick him off the film after post-production, but I don't, you know, none of those rumors are substantiated by anybody. I don't, and it doesn't come up at all on this Blu-ray. So I don't know if he was happy with the final cut, but it feels as Tobe Hooper as any movie can get. So I would be surprised if anything was changed, you know, dramatically after he was done directing it.
Yeah. But also, would you be able to know the difference since he was taken off so many of his movies that, like, part of his directorial style is someone else finishing them?
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. I would be surprised. I would be surprised because there's so much craziness in this movie. In every single scene. I mean, you mentioned the possessed refrigerator. You know, that scene is batshit crazy. With the,
that
you know,
starts with a dead kid. It's got a, like, and just like
this, like, that's angelic blonde dead kid. This green tinged fog. These doves or pigeons flying all around for some reason.
The, like, the beat cop that it keeps cutting to for his reaction.
Who's dressed in like a Nazi uniform or something? Like, you know.
Yeah, he's dressed like a Mountie. I guess they couldn't get a real American police officer uniform down in South Africa.
It, but it's
and then
perfect.
Also, and then the then we haven't even talked about the crime scene photographer.
Oh,
who's
yeah,
who's a young man in old man makeup. He's the same actor who plays the
mortician,
coroner.
Yeah,
yeah.
JJJ Picturman.
It's so weird later in that movie because he's like, "Hey, Picturman," and you think he's the crime scene photographer. This is his nickname for this guy is the Picture Man, and then there's a letter from him late in the movie where his name is Pictureman. That's his last name.
I love it. I really love it.
I really liked the relationship between him and the Ted Levine character. It was like this odd, like, is this guy really here kind of thing at first, but then you're seeing other people interacting with him, so you know he's there, but it was almost like a some kind of a weird, you know, spiritual ghost partner, you know, like, that was just hanging around. Yeah. They'd seen a lot together, the two of them. Like, it was really interesting that there's so, you know, the more I think about it, the more interesting stuff there is in the movie. And that's what I was responding to, I think, was just like these, all these little bits and the processing of those bits is helping me understand where you guys are at with this thing, you know, and knowing that full well that I'll be coming more towards where you're at the more I see it, you know, because there is so much. Hooper is so idiosyncratic in his approach and his, these little touches, you know, these crazy little things that I can legitimately go, I've never seen this or this in a movie, or I've never seen this combination of these things in a movie, you know, like, never, you know? So that's pretty remarkable. When you've seen as many movies as you guys and I have, you start thinking about these things, you're like, wow, there's something really specific about his creative take. Yeah. You know, it's almost like Lynchian in a way, in terms of, like, some of the stuff he's doing, and that's not like anything else, you know? And I think because he's so sort of seen as a quasi-conventional genre filmmaker, he doesn't get the credit that a Lynch would get for being a creative visionary. And by my own admission, I sometimes don't give him that credit. And in just discussing it, things are starting to click for me. I'm like, wow, how did I, you know, I've always respected him, but it's making a little bit more sense just having this conversation, you know?
He's weird. That's what I love about him a lot, though, is what you're saying is that there's not other movies like these movies that he's made in his career. And it might seem like there are, but really there aren't, you know. The biggest example of that is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, of course, which is like so many horror movies in its setup, but it's actually nothing like them. And The Mangler is sort of like that in like any number of possessed appliance movies. Like, I don't even know. It's a genre, certainly, though, where there's a cop who's, there's a murder and there's like an occult thing going on behind the murder, an occult conspiracy, and he's got to investigate it. So that's like a fairly common genre, horror subgenre. But it's so weird. One moment I was struck by that I really like this time is right after Ted Levine gets his jacket caught in The Mangler and has to shoot his own jacket off, which is so strange in and of itself.
My favorite scene.
But right after that, when he's going home and he gets his jacket caught in his car door as he's getting out, and he freaks out, and it's played as a joke, right? A little bit, that he's gotten his jacket caught in the car door as he's trying to get out into his driveway. But he's also terrified. And I think that that's part of the line that Toby Hooper slices in a way that's very specific to him, is right along this line of genuine terror and very broad comedy, that he's frequently like slicing straight down that line. You know, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 exists. Every single scene is that tension between broad comedy and real terror, you know? And I think that that's like the, just that little moment of him getting his jacket caught in the car door. And it's like, ha ha ha. But then Ted Levine keeps it going and the camera keeps it on longer and turns it into, no, it's not a joke. He's freaking out. Wow, that's upsetting. And now it's gone back from being upsetting to be funny again in some way, to think about how upsetting this all is to me.
You know what's...
And I think that...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, nobody does that. Only him.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I want to jump into the special features yet, but just in the commentary by Stephen David Brooks, the co-writer, he mentions something that he feels is a really significant cut that they made in the film that didn't... that made it hard for audiences to understand the tone of the film, or that it was supposed to be funny in any way, was that when Mrs. Frawley, the first victim of the Mangler, gets sucked into the machine and gets crushed, she has a Timex watch on.
That's a...
And afterwards, they were going to make a joke about, because at the time, the advertisement was Timex watches, you know, don't break. So that after...
Take a licking, keep on ticking.
Right,
or
so, right, exactly. So after she gets pulled through this machine and ripped to shreds, they were going to show the Timex watch cracked but still going, still ticking. And they ended up cutting that yeah. shot out, which he feels like that early on in the movie, if they had seen that, he feels a lot of audiences would have been on board with the film a lot more, you know.
But there's still a great joke in that scene that's, again, like an upsetting joke, where the niece character, what is that character's name?
Sherry.
The main character who's supposed to be 16.
Sherry.
Yeah. Sherry. She tries to help stop Mrs. Frawley from getting consumed by the machine, and she's left with Mrs. Frawley's foot. And she's holding onto her foot and like cradling it against her chest like it's a baby, because she doesn't know what else to do, because the rest of this woman's body has just been pulled through the machine and squished. And it's this very like, it's funny to see the way she's sort of like holding it and cradling it, a fucking foot. And then it's obviously horrifying. So to me, maybe it's too subtle of comedy, but it comes through. Same thing when Ted Levine shows up, when Hunton shows up on the scene and everybody's like, oh, I'm so sick, it's so grisly. And he's like, oh, you pussies, essentially. And then goes inside and sees the mess and throws up instantly. That's a great joke. The like grizzled cop who's here to be grizzled, and then he can't handle this either and he pukes immediately.
Yeah, or some of the physical comedy with the refrigerator too. And you know, the fact that it comes when it shows up later and it's just sitting there in front of this house and nobody knows how it got there and it's killed a kid. You're like, oh my God, this is a weird movie. Sorry, Brian, go ahead.
No, you're totally right. I was just going to say, I love that Ted Levine, they say in the commentary that he used vanilla milkshakes for his vomit and that they just kept shoveling vanilla milkshakes at him to throw up. That's the first I've heard of that specific take. But yeah, no, you're right. There's so much. I think that's the big thing for me that I've always encountered as a slight issue with him, is the humor and the terror and me not being in the right frame of mind sometimes to be able to handle that. I still am working my way through, you know, don't hate me guys, but working my way through Texas Chainsaw 2 in terms of coming to fully appreciate it, because my initial reaction was one of just, I absolutely hated it. And
yeah.
But that's, you know, I don't know when I saw it. I must've seen it, you know, 20 years ago.
I despised it the first time I saw it. And I've only sort of gradually come around to, I appreciate it only as a Toby Hooper movie and as a Toby Hooper fan.
Yeah.
But I really hated it as a just another terrible canon movie where just the worst destruction of something that I really loved with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, just more canon bullshit. You know, I really just did not have any patience for it.
But that's the one that I point to a lot where I go, okay, maybe I don't get Toby Hooper. And the more I watch it and the more I see his other work, I see that humor, which is, like you guys have said, it's an essential part of his approach. And I think that is always going to alienate people when you do something where they don't know if you're joking or not. There's an immediate sort of reaction of defensive, like, how dare you try and make a joke that I don't get, or how dare you try and be smarter than me? And it just, it makes this knee jerk. And I think that's what happened to me, and that's what happens to a lot of people. So I'm sure that the idea of him having to deal with, you know, studio people or financiers or whoever, and saying, I really want to keep that shot of the Timex watch, because that's, to me, in his mind, that's key to this scene and setting up the comedy, and having somebody say, no, we got to lose that, and not understanding that they're sort of fucking with the audience's experience of what he's trying to do, and how one shot could really make a difference in terms of being clear about a joke or not. You know, that's a big deal. You know, when you're a filmmaker that gets fucked with a lot, it's too bad.
Yeah,
it's true, but I think it really... it kind of made him the artist it was. Like, our friend Kevin Marr likes to compare him to Orson Welles, of all people, you know, because they were two filmmakers who got fucked with by studios, right? And a lot of people say they never made a pure 100% version of a movie they wanted after their initial huge success, right after Citizen Kane and after Texas Chainsaw, that, you know, all those films were changed, you know, or were compromised in some way that against the artist. And you see a lot of that in this movie with all the low angles and the ceilings that you see in pretty much every location. He shoots at, you know, Mark's house and Gartley's office and the mansion, the hospital, the morgue, you know, all have these amazing low shots where you just see this overwhelming ceiling above them. Is like a very well singing, like you said, the Everett Sloan reference that the Robert Englund, based it on. So I love that. But I feel like Orson Welles, it's sort of in his character, it's sort of in his art that he is compromised. You know, it's interesting. It makes him kind of more of an artist. I think that some of the things that he has to say about industries and, you know, societies could be read as like his thoughts on a film, or like the production of a film that, you know, the Laundry Institute could be seen, you know, as a way of, you know, the high ups looking down at the lowly people trying to, you know, who had to put the sheets in, you know, had to load it like a film.
Yeah. In most of his films, there's that element of satire as well, of that it's a critique, if not satire, of systems, of institutions like that.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. Well, and just it's an obvious metaphor, but the idea of the film itself being the sheets or the people, I guess, and not wanting to get sucked into the machine of the Hollywood, you know, mangler, if you will, that destroys. That's an obvious, like I said, sort of point of view, but I mean, he could be going for something like that, you know, knowing the kind of satire that he could layer into a film.
100%. I totally buy it. Yeah. It's great. It's all, like Chris was saying, all of his films have this, you know, thing running through them where, if I could just for a second, King's book, right? Or his story, The Mangler. It ends with the Mangler getting up and like running amok in town and killing everybody, right? And that's how it ends. I think it's interesting that Hooper decided
to have... So that's not Hooper's fault.
Right, that is not Hooper's fault that it gets up and runs around. I think it's just interesting that Hooper very specifically wanted to end it with the Mangler back in place, you know, planted where it was, and nothing, despite everything that's happened, has changed. Because I think King's fears are based on this ultimate destruction, right? The evil manifests and evolves into a pestilence that will destroy society, that the high school will burn down, that the town is overrun by vampires, the family will be annihilated. I think what scares Toby Hooper is the idea that nothing will ever change, that good can challenge evil, but the evil is so firmly rooted that you'll never be able to pull it out. You can't bring it down with a chainsaw, no matter how much Dennis Hopper energy you have in you. You know, you can remove the headstones, but the bodies will always be there. You can keep peeling away the layers, but there's always a building inside of a building. So I think that, you know, it's so deeply, the evil for Hooper is so deeply rooted and based on these machines that are constantly running that you have nothing to do with. It was there before you were born. It'll be there after you die. And The Mangler, for me, one of the reasons I love it is that it really leans into this idea of this thing that exists perpetually, that that's just the way the society is run, and that you can do all the good you want. You can, you know, try to exorcise these demons and like save yourself from it. But at the end of the day, it's still going to be the victims coming to this slaughterhouse, right? Just like in Texas Chainsaw, like people come to it to offer themselves up, to sacrifice themselves up to this pre-existing thing.
Well, and that lines John, right up. Oh. Right, sorry, I was going to say that lines right up with the Hollywood metaphor too. You know,
oh, yeah.
Every
yeah.
creative filmmaker offers themselves up and gets, you know, a lot of them get chewed up. You know, it's what happens. But the system doesn't change much, and people continue to do it. So, I mean, not saying that's what he's going for, but that's just one read. But yeah, I love this idea of...
Oh, absolutely. You know, yeah, yeah. This, and again, this idea that, you know, Hooper doesn't trust producers and doesn't trust the system, and that he's constantly screwed over by it. Exactly. He has reason not to be.
Never, yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy to think that a man with the breadth and the amount of films that he made, and the amount of interesting, and I think a lot of people would argue good films, like you said, maybe never got a pure vision on the screen, but B, kept at it, kept going. You know, like mm-hmm. that is really inspiring in a lot of ways, more than I had even realized until this conversation, you know?
Yeah, and he, particularly later in his career, post Mangler, he has some really interesting movies that are completely disregarded. His remake of Toolbox Murders, Mortuary, and Gin, even, are all interesting films, and in some ways more interesting as films than his more like canonized stuff like Invaders from Mars and Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, that I think that he continues on as a filmmaker in spite of everything in a way that's fascinating, you know, but not necessarily so off model for a lot of horror directors.
Yeah, leading up to
things
it too.
Changed. Yeah. Yeah,
Spontaneous Combustion, I'm Dangerous Tonight, Night Terrors, all of them got completely dismissed, and there's a lot of interesting stuff to be found in there.
Yeah, yeah, those that bad run of non-success following Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 is just... It's hard to imagine having to go through that as a filmmaker, what that must have been like as an artist for him. It's enough to make you want to throw your flowers in the trash, John.
It is. I feel like that John Hunton walking away dejected from the Blue Ribbon Laundry is definitely Toby Hooper.
You're dressed up in your finest denim going to meet a young lady.
That's the Hooper look, flowers. Man. That's the Hooper look. He's Mr. Jean Jacket, yeah. Never wears ties.
Well, do you guys mind? Let's talk about the features here, and I'm especially curious. I mean, I got a decent amount out of this stuff, but like you said, John, you guys maybe both didn't have a lot to go on going into this, so I'm hoping that you found these rewarding features on this new disc.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the commentary is breezy, John. Is that how you'd describe it?
Very laid back. I definitely enjoyed it. I think Brooks seems like a good guy who definitely knows what he's talking about. He's sort of the, can't think of his name, the Kubrick guy.
From Filmworker.
Yes, Filmworker, yeah. He's sort of his, like, right-hand man, because we've been with him since Life Force.
Leon Vitali.
And in this one, he was the co-screenwriter, he was a effects supervisor and a second unit direction. So he was very involved in making this film, and it's very refreshing to hear his thoughts and made it sound like it was that everyone, you know, worked hard and had a good time, you know, despite, you know, being stuck in Johannesburg and having food that, you know, didn't agree with everybody, apparently. My favorite story that he tells is the origin of Ted Levine's line, "miserable piece of dog fuck," which apparently was based on a optical printer that they had at Buena Vista that they dubbed PDF, piece of dog fuck. Because it would always break down, and they would refer to any infernal machine as a PDF. So he actually gave that line specifically to Levine as an homage to this optical printer that apparently didn't work.
Wow.
So yeah, that's fun. My favorite thing of the special features is the behind the scenes footage, that 12 minutes. Just seeing, and you know, I don't want to get into the whole non-controversy of Poltergeist again, but just to see Hooper on set giving specific directions to actors in control of the shots, doing what anyone who's a fan of Hooper knows he does on every film, that, you know, he's the artist who does this. He's not like Spielberg, who has, you know, a whole army of publicists who are going to take his picture to prove he's the genius behind this film. He's a laid back guy. He just does his job. But to see these, you know, uninterrupted 12 minutes of him goofing around with the crew, having fun with the Mrs. Frowley mannequin, you know, it warmed my heart. It was great, you know, to see him in his environment being in charge of this huge operation, you know, and even though he may not have trusted the studios and the producers who constantly screwed him over, you see this is what he was born to do, you know? So I really appreciate that that's there, that, you know, I guess it was provided by, again, William, who had done the Mangler, made the Mangler. So I'm glad that that was involved here. That was by far my favorite thing. Although the England interview is great as well.
Nice. Yeah, I got through the England interview and about three quarters of the commentary. I didn't get a chance to look at the Hooper footage, so now I got to check that out. What did you think of the features? Anything stand out to you? Anything interesting that we haven't talked about that you learned, maybe?
You tell me you like the tribal taxi wars that almost killed Robert England in Johannesburg.
I missed this. I forgot about this. I thought I watched the whole interview, but I missed it.
Oh, you missed that part? John? Really? That was crazy. It's apparently there was some kind of a tribal war going on between taxi companies, and so you weren't supposed to get into a certain taxi because the other company would come after you. And Robert England and his wife were coming back from dinner, just innocently got into a cab. It was the wrong cab, it turns out. And so, yeah, they freaked out and had to be let off right away and were worried that they were going to be killed for calling a cab, which, you know, at that time in South Africa, I'm sure, was a very real scary thing to happen to you, you know, even if you're a well-known, you know, Hollywood movie star like Robert England.
Yeah, crazy.
Oh, you know what I also love in the commentary is it's revealed when Hunton is hunched over alone in his house with the picture of his dead wife next to him. That was Toby Hooper's girlfriend cameoing as the picture of his dead wife.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Rita was her name.
That's apparently on the commentary track?
Yeah.
I didn't notice that.
Nice.
But lots of good stuff. Really enjoyed it.
So as Mangler fans, you guys were pretty happy with this edition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it looks good, the new 4K scan. I mean, 2K, sorry, it's a 2K scan of camera negative. I haven't seen it. I don't know if I've watched the other transfer, even from the previous DVD, but this looked really nice to me. I don't know.
That looked great.
Yeah, it looked great. John mentioned it earlier. I could not detect any difference in terms of this being the unrated director's cut of it. I just don't even... Don't go in expecting that you're going to see a whole new film in some way with it, or missing scenes and those 60 seconds are going to be, or whatever it is, are going to redo it. But even though I'm glad they did the correct version, it's not a radical change in that way. It's very much the movie I remember it being, is what I would say about
it. Yeah, and they don't market it either saying, you know, this is the special unrated version or anything like that.
No. I don't think there's any... I don't think they're trying to pull the old bait and switch.
The other thing I took from the special features was everybody feels like they got to track down Daniel Matmore. Apparently he was a very popular guy. He plays Mark in the movie, the brother-in-law, the neighbor. With Robert England and Stephen David Brooks separately are like, I got to track that guy down. He was a really great guy. So
doesn't he have some weird story? God damn, what is his story in real life? He is the guy who made that movie Homeboys 2, Crack City. Yes, I'm remembering now exactly. He's the director and writer of these weird direct-to-video like exploitation movies. Do you know this about him, John?
I don't. I knew he co-wrote Night Terrors for Hooper, but I didn't know his directing career.
He wrote and directed this movie called Homeboys 2, Crack City, and I don't think there's a Homeboys 1. I think it's one of those things.
I love those.
Where it's like a, it's just like a completely, it's like an almost Miami Connection-esque, bizarre curio, like VHS-era curio. And he did another movie called Buffalo Heart, which I don't believe that I've seen, but he was like a weird artist in his own right. Let me look him up.
Sounds like I'm going to have to track down Daniel Matmore myself.
He looked up, he wrote Night Terrors.
Right.
Toby Hooper's Night Terrors.
Yes, I knew that. Right? Yeah.
Okay. I'm looking at the cover for Homeboys 2 Crack City and I am intrigued. looks like break-in in like a really dark universe. Although obviously I know there's no breakdancing in the movie, but
oh,
it looks like...
Oh, wait, I'm looking at the cover now. Not a single one of those people is in this movie.
That's great.
That is not the class. Classic. The cast of Homeboys 2.
Classic.
Scream Factory, get on it.
Now apparently what he's doing now is he's doing all of this video game voiceover. Is what
wow.
It looks like.
Crazy.
Okay.
Well, let Robert Englund know. Apparently he's wants to get in touch.
Nice. Well, any closing thoughts, guys, on the disc or the movie or anything we haven't talked about?
Just that, you know, give it a shot. If anyone else out there who's never seen it before or who very reasonably passed it over in the 90s when it came out, it's worth revisiting. It's worth, you know, reappraising. I'm glad that we have this opportunity to do so, and I hope, like with John Carpenter and Wes Craven, that Scream Factory will bring out some other Hooper movies, you know, that haven't got representation. I'm Dangerous Tonight would be great to have on Blu-ray.
Absolutely.
I've not seen that.
Oh, that's a great one. That's a classic.
Gotta see it.
When I saw you at the dance, I realized what you had done with the cloak. But when nothing happened to you, I put it out of my mind. Where is the dress now?
Imagine it in the hands of someone utterly evil, someone more vulnerable to its power than you are.
What do you want?
We have to talk. The dress is not destroyed.
Machen Amick, D. Wallace Stone, and Anthony Perkins star in I'm Dangerous Tonight.
You've got to see it.
I'd like to.
That's the haunted dress movie based on a Colonel Woolrich story.
Yeah, all you had to well, you'd have me at Colonel Woolrich, but haunted dress story you had me. And,
it's a haunted Aztec burial cloak that gets turned into a cocktail dress.
Love it.
It's dynamite. It's dynamite.
Is that one only on VHS right now? Is that on DVD?
I think it's,
you can
yeah,
get
I think
it
it's
on
VHS.
Region 2 DVD.
Oh.
I have that.
Good to know.
But yeah.
Good to know. Yeah, I got to check
I would
that
say
out.
With the Mangler, if you have seen the Mangler and you didn't like the Mangler, it's okay. Not everybody likes good movies. Some people have terrible taste. It's fine if you didn't like the Mangler. You just don't understand cinema, and you should never see another movie ever again. That's my feeling on it.
Is that what you said to your date back in 1995?
I believe we went to Wendy's afterwards, and very little was said between us.
Nice.
Is what I believe how that date was. No, I actually remember tons of details. I'm not telling you any of the details of this date I went on when I was 16.
Well, you were about to be sacrificed to the Mangler, so you had to get out there while you could.
Well, I just got to say thank you so much, gentlemen, for pitching the idea, for coming on the show and talking about it, for giving me a greater appreciation of the movie that I'm still processing in my own head, and for pushing me in the direction of watching it and a new greater appreciation for Toby Hooper, which I'm always looking for. I really appreciate you guys doing this, so thank you so much.
I'm so glad.
Thank you for having us on.
So glad you got a chance to see it for the first time. I'm so happy I could eat a stack of Bibles for breakfast.
I know. You will say bullshit reality, reality bullshit in your head all the time. I guarantee it. It will stay with you.
That was pretty fucking memorable, I gotta say.
But is that your favorite Ted Levine line from the movie? I gotta say mine.
Well, say yours. That's pretty close. I don't know.
I don't care if you're delivering a pizza to the fucking Pope.
Also great. Good stuff.
That's officer asshole to you, right, scene at the beginning?
yeah, when he's yelling at the delivery guys.
That is good. Officer asshole is great. Yeah, that whole...
I do also appreciate in the big climax after, you know, they've... that Robert Englund's character, spoilers, has gotten mangled by the Mangler... that he just says, fuck you, to like the crazy machine and Robert Englund. He just looks at him and goes, fuck you.
That is pretty great.
He is one of the great sayers of fuck in movies, I think.
Oh my God.
I kind of have to agree with that. It's pretty solid. His fuckitude is pretty solid.
We're solid Mangler fuck-a-tude. Super fans. We are Ted Levine super duper fans, is what I would also say about us.
Yeah, well, that was another thing, was giving me another look at Ted Levine, because I'm fairly limited in my experience with him, and I loved seeing him get like a full-on you know, main role like this, and what he decided to do with it. I was fascinated, absolutely fascinated by him in this.
He's a fascinating guy. But, yeah, I'd say what's even second place? Is it Joyride? His voice work in Joyride? I mean, this is, you know, this is his vehicle.
Candy cane.
Yeah,
this is his, isn't second place Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs? He's pretty memorable in that role.
He is. So much different than this role that I didn't even make the connection until I was listening to the commentary. It was like a, what? Oh my God. Wow. Okay. That kind of thing. I was like, I know this guy. How do I fucking know this guy? And I didn't bother to look it up at the time. So yeah, that was a really neat thing to suddenly, whoa, okay.
And apparently he told Stephen Brooks that people would send him like pieces of skin and stuff. It's like, oh man. Yeah, that kind of creeped me out.
My favorite Ted Levine moment, though, is in Heat, where they're walking with Al Pacino. He's one of the, like, the detectives in Al Pacino's crew, and it's the, you know what he's looking at? He's looking at us scene, right? Mm-hmm. And Al Pacino, clearly unscripted, whips his CB towards Ted Levine, who only just barely fucking catches it and gets this look on his face like, what the fuck? It's a wonderful moment. He can't disguise his total, like, Jesus Christ, Al Pacino, warn me when you whip a CB at my head.
Okay, now I gotta go back and watch that tonight. That's fucking great. I totally forgot about that.
Hope it's Ted Levine is the one that catches it and I'm not remembering it wrong. I haven't seen Heat since it came out in, like, 95. So,
could have been West Dunes. Nice. You don't know.
No, I'm sure it's Ted Levine. I'm sure it is. If it's not, and you check this, please cut all this shit out. Would be my request.
But anyway, we'll wrap this up for the night. But I got to have you guys back on. We got to figure out another movie that you both want to talk about because this was a blast. And so thank you.
Anytime.
Again.
Anytime. It was a ton of fun. Thanks for having us on.
Of course. Everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray filled week, and we will talk to you very soon. Good night.